Session number 10203, Reel 1.
Mr. Nunnally, Reel 1. When and how was it that you came to be involved with East African troops in the first place, Mr. Nunnally?
I was commissioned in September 1941, and I was posted immediately to the 9th Battalion of the Somerset Light Infantry, then based at Launceston in Cornwall. When I arrived, I was appalled to find that I was going to be third in command of a platoon, because so many junior officers had been commissioned in the months immediately preceding that there was a surplus of subalterns. And, of course, this was quite intolerable from my point of view. And so I immediately began to volunteer for everything that came up on the notice board. At that time, there were calls for volunteers for a tremendously wide range of duties, both in Britain and abroad, and I applied for such units as the special forces, which were clearly being formed, but I didn't get anywhere with that. And then there came on the notice board a requirement for junior officers to volunteer for special services in the Far East. I put my name down and was selected.
When would this have been?
This was in October 1941. And whilst the convoy was at sea, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The convoy was diverted and then held in places like Cape Town and Durban. I was held in Durban with my draft of 30 junior officers. And then, because of the events in the Far East, we were sent up to Mombasa and then Nairobi. And I was then posted to the 3rd, 6th, which was a Tanganyika battalion of the King's African Rifles, then in Abyssinia.
Again, can you put a date to that?
Yes, that was in January 1942.
Can you tell me a bit about the 3rd, 6th battalion, what it was, what it was comprised of?
Yes, the 3rd, 6th battalion was raised in Tanganyika. It had askaris drawn from a considerable number of tribes, Tanganyika being such a large country. Interestingly, the fathers of quite a significant number of the askaris serving in the 3rd, 6th had actually served in the German army in World War I, when von Leto Vorbeck was harrying the British in Tanganyika. The battalion had British officers, senior British non-commissioned officers, and I suppose about 1,100 askaris drawn from this multiplicity of tribes. The battalion had been officered initially principally by Kenya and other East African farmers, settlers, and I suppose employees of banks seconded from their British bank to work in East Africa. I think that perhaps I and another subaltern who joined at that time were the first imperial officers, as we were called by these colonials, whose informality of approach to soldiering we then found ourselves also enjoying. Subsequently, of course, the ratio of imperials to colonials greatly increased, because many of the colonials then returned to their farms, but by no means all of them. And when we carried on into Burma, many seem to have remained rather than go back to civilian occupations, like growing pyrethrum for DDT and a host of other war-productive activities of that agricultural kind.
In what ways was their soldiering casual?
The difference between a normal British Army unit and a colonial unit, in my experience, was that whilst all the normal disciplines most certainly applied when one was on parade, and there was no lack of zeal in a military sense whatever, it was after hours that the informality most manifested itself. We would, for example, in camp in Somaliland or Abyssinia, have a small circle of 180-pound tents around a campfire. We would have our sundowners, and we would only eat in our small mess tent when we felt like it after sundowners. Now, we might not actually eat dinner until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. I couldn't conceive of any British Army unit stretching its eating hours in that way. The whole atmosphere was different from my experience of my Somerset Light Infantry, brief period of weeks. And subsequently, when I returned eventually to Britain, I saw the same old disciplines reassert themselves that I had forgotten about almost.
Did the British officers find it suitable, this informality, or irksome?
I think that all of us found it most agreeable. It seemed to bring out the qualities of a greater sense of responsibility also towards the African. It's different from soldiering with British troops, where even a platoon commander does his best, I am quite sure, to listen to the grievances and the problems of his soldiers. But in the case of serving with Africans, first you have to learn the language and be proficient at it. Secondly, you have to understand as best you can the differences in tribal attitudes and tribal relationships. Thirdly, you must, of course, remember that you are the leader of those men and you must lead them into battle. You must look after them, ensure their training. And whilst you do that with British troops as well, it is to a heightened degree, in my experience, when you are dealing with African troops, that you address your duties.
What might happen otherwise?
Subsequently, in Burma, it became quite clear that askaris would perhaps panic. Indeed, some did, in different East African units, particularly if they didn't know their officers. If, therefore, there was a continuity of service, and if the junior officer, first of all, liked his soldiers, and secondly, was determined to do his best by them, the reward would be that they would follow him into battle, and it would be the proper spirit of each man helping his mate in battle. I think that is what was proved to me on numerous occasions, just as I had seen more than once when a reinforcement officer, reinforcing as a result of casualties, took over a platoon and was then sent into action. If he hadn't had time to develop that relationship that I have spoken about with his troops, it could lead to a very uncertain situation at best.
Did you personally like the Ascaris?
Very much indeed. I counted myself very fortunate to have been posted to a Tanganyika battalion. I felt an affinity with these different tribesmen. I enjoyed their company. I had a great respect for them. They were, after all, in the main, plainsmen. They were not jungle men. And yet, in the end, in Burma, they acquitted themselves with enormous courage and the application of their innate skills, such as tracking in the jungle. I was very happy with the King's African Rifles in that particular battalion.
What attracted them to you?
I think, really, that I am a product, of course, as we all are, of our times. And I was brought up reading such books as The Four Feathers, the stories of the South African War, the Zulu Wars. I was a passionate reader of the histories of the great battles and campaigns in World War I. And my father had served in the South African War with the South Australian Mounted Rifles, and a similar mounted infantry units. And he'd also served in World War I with the Royal Fusiliers. And so I knew instinctively that I would be an infantry officer. I knew perfectly well what my responsibilities must be towards my men. It all came naturally to me. It's a funny thing, really, I suppose, that I had no doubts whatever but that in that war I should be leading troops into action. And it was just the fall of the cards that it happened to be with African troops.
What were the human qualities which attracted you to the Africans there?
I think the affection and trust that they demonstrated, if one obviously liked being with them, their readiness to put up with all kinds of discomfort, After all, they were, in a sense, mercenaries. They had answered a call, perhaps uttered by their tribal chief, to serve King E. George. But King E. George, a remote figure, the aspirations of policy by the British government meant very little to them, but they were prepared for 2 shillings a day to be askaris of King E. George. Now, that seemed to me to place a very great responsibility upon everybody who was a European, not to let those people down and to develop their best qualities, and generally set them an example that one would not be ashamed of.
Can you draw a comparison between the askaris and British troops from your own experience, how they would compare with each other from the point of view of an officer leading them?
I can't really, because when I was commissioned into the Somerset Light Infantry, as I said, I was there such a short time in order to escape the drudgery of being third in command of a platoon of 32 men, that I didn't lead British troops into action. Therefore, I can only say that my good fortune was to lead African troops into action.
Are you an Australian or British?
Well, in fact, I was born in Australia, and my intention at the outbreak of war, when I was living in Britain, had been to join the Australian forces in Australia. But I was given an exit permit, which was necessary in those days, but my mother was not granted an exit permit, and she particularly had wished to return to Australia, and so I cancelled that deal. It just held me back from joining the British Army a few months. In fact, I did join underage. I was fairly desperate to get into action, and in fact, in the invasion of the German invasion of Norway, I heard that an international brigade similar to that which had served in the Spanish Civil War was being formed, and so I hastened off to Norway House to join this international brigade of volunteers, only to be frustrated because the British government refused to allow anybody who was of military age or approaching military age to join other countries' forces or to serve other than in the British forces.
Which part of Australia do you come from?
Sydney.
And did you hold Australian citizenship at this time we're talking about?
Yes. In fact, it was really an accident of birth. I was, you could say, of dual nationality until 1948, when the option came, choose one or the other. And having lived by that time in Britain, I chose to remain a British subject and not become an Australian subject.
Coming back to the askaris, what tribes did they actually come from? Can you enumerate any of them?
Yes. The Wagogo, the Wanyamwezi, were two. The Yao, that's Y-A-O, that's three tribes. I can think of quite a number of others, but those three are fairly representative. There was another smaller tribe, the Wahehe, who were as vigorous and lithe as the Wagogo tended to be rather ponderous and rather heavy in their physique.
Why should certain tribes have been recruited rather than others?
Well, I'm not sure there's any discrimination as between one tribe and another. They all put up their representatives, you might say. And the third sixth was representative of those different tribes. And of course, in my experience, there was no evidence whatever at any time of tribal differences asserting themselves in the third sixth. And I'm quite sure that the same thing would apply in other battalions. They mixed. You might have six different tribes in a single platoon, and they all mucked in together.
No tribal rivalries?
No, not detectable to us.
People sometimes accuse the British of adopting a policy of divide and rule. Do you think there's any truth in that?
In my slight experience, absolutely none whatever. We were all soldiers. We had common purpose. No, I would say, without question, there was no evidence of that kind of attitude or policy, whatever.
So one tribe wouldn't be played off against another?
Categorically not.
And would you ever have any units like a platoon solely composed of one tribe?
Never.
Why not?
Because it wasn't necessary. I can't imagine why it should happen that a platoon or even a section of a platoon should be made up of one tribe. There'd be no gain in doing so. Possibly there might be distinct disadvantages. One wasn't looking for a competitive spirit as between one man and another. One was looking for a competitive spirit between one platoon and another, one company and another, one battalion and another, but certainly not to exploit in any sense the tribal differences of the troops.
What about things like feeding? Would that cause any problems with one tribe preferring certain types of food to another?
Again, not in my experience. They were standard rations for all.
What did the standard rations consist of for African troops?
Maize meal, posho, meat, rice, vegetables as available in different parts of the world that we were serving in. Fruit, of course. Very standard and basic diet.
Would you eat the same as the Africans?
No, not in terms of eating the standard maize meal posho, but certainly the same sort of meat. Potatoes, sweet potatoes or ordinary potatoes. In other words, everything except the maize meal.
What were the soldierly qualities of the Askaris who were under you from the point of view of things like marksmanship, discipline, and so on?
I think the answer to that is how well did they behave when the time came for them to demonstrate the value of their training. In marksmanship terms, I would say an average performance. Of course, there would be bound to be some who would become snipers who demonstrated a greater aptitude and skill. So far as Bren gunners are concerned, one couldn't find fault with their handling of a light machine gun. So far as the 3-inch mortar was concerned, and I was for a time second in command of the battalion's mortar platoon, no criticisms whatever. And if you ever tried to lug the parts of a 3-inch mortar around the country and the jungle, you'll know that it takes a tremendous amount of physical effort, and if you then have to put that mortar into action, all the training you've ever had has got to be applied intelligently and rapidly. They certainly did that. They were not afraid, any more than the rest of us, of attacking. They did not like to be caught in an ambush, but then who would, irrespective of race, colour and creed, like to be caught in an ambush? It's a very nasty experience. My happy experience it was that my soldiers stayed with me, and therefore I think that's a tribute to the training that they'd received from my predecessors as platoon commander, as well as anything that I was able to contribute to their training.
What kind of discipline problems would they present?
Silly problems. For example, a tendency to sleep whilst on sentry duty. There was an incident I very well remember in British Somaliland when my company, which was D Company of the 3rd 6th, was on detachment at a place called Mandera, about 20 miles from Berbera. No, come to think of it, I was about 40 miles from Berbera. And our task was to guard an Italian prisoner of war camp, which was set in the scrub, bush and sand of Somaliland. The camp consisted of two parts. One was a camp for male prisoners, and the other for women who had were Italian colonials, often with their children, awaiting repatriation, which in fact took place in April 1942. The system was that an officer of the guard would be located in a tent at the just outside the main gate. Sentries would be posted around the outer perimeter, and sentries also at certain points within the camp itself. And this was a 24-hour guard. Naturally, the officer on duty obviously had to go and inspect the sentry posts at any time of the day and night. It happened that I made my rounds as dawn broke one day, and inside the camp I found a sentry fast asleep in his sentry box, and his rifle propped by the side of the box. I woke him up, placed him under arrest, and replaced him with another man. The offending sentry was then charged with, whilst a sentry asleep at his post. The punishment was 12 lashes of the rhino hide whip. And of course, this was my first experience of this type of formal punishment. The arrangements were, to say the least, dramatic. The company was drawn up on three sides of the small parade ground. A frame was brought out, and the sentry was attached, let's say, to the frame. The African sergeant major was the NCO responsible for overseeing the punishment. The British company sergeant major stood well to one side. When the scene was otherwise set, the company